From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama went to Capitol Hill today to meet with Democrats to strategize on saving Obamacare, his legacy legislation. Vice President-elect Mike Pence went as well to help Republican lawmakers get ready to dismantle it. Pence said it will be the first order of business in the Trump administration, and they have the mandate.
Our president-elect took his case to the American people to repeal and replace Obamacare. And the American people voted decisively for a better future for health care in this country. And we are determined to give them that.
NPR congressional correspondent Elsa Chang is following all of this. Hi, Elsa.
Hi there.
And start with Mike Pence, who spoke to reporters along with House Speaker Paul Ryan, vehement about taking the law apart. But did we learn anything more about how they do that?
Not really. House Speaker Paul Ryan was asked repeatedly if Republicans had a replacement plan, but he gave no real clear answers. Republicans have actually already started paving the way, however, to repeal the law. They've introduced legislation in the Senate to get that process started. But the challenge for them is this. Do they want to repeal and replace simultaneously, or repeal first, delay the effective date of that repeal, and then replace later? And there's still no consensus among Republicans on what they should do.
Yeah, and here's Paul Ryan promising to at least not take the rug out from underneath people who already have health insurance.
Then once we repeal this law, we need to make sure that there is a stable transition to a truly patient-centered system. We want every American to have access to quality, affordable health coverage.
But again, no specifics. Look, there are reports today about a new poll from the Center for American Progress that showed that when things like Obamacare are couched in positive terms, Trump supporters approve them. And they also say that they expect Democrats to keep Trump in check on things. One analyst says this is new in American politics. People who voted for Trump but expect the Democrats to block or oppose his agenda. And even Donald Trump tweeted today, Republican lawmakers need to be very careful as they move forward not to shoulder the blame for what he called the Obamacare disaster. Are you hearing from Republicans on the Hill that they realize this is a tightrope they're on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in that tweet, Donald Trump seems to be warning Republicans that there should not be any disruption to families because of this repeal. Basically, he's reminding them that they, Republicans, could just as easily be accused of what Democrats were accused of after the rollout of the health care law, when people saw their premiums go up or they couldn't keep their old plans. House Speaker Paul Ryan this morning said the goal was to not hurt families and leave them uncovered. Vice President-elect Mike Pence said the same thing this morning after meeting with the House Republicans. But again, how do you do that? And this is why it's complicated. Trump has already said he wants to keep parts of the health care law intact, like not excluding people who have pre-existing conditions or allowing young people to stay on their parents' plan until they're 26 years old. But if Republicans get rid of the individual mandate, which is probably the most objectionable aspect of the law to the GOP.
It requires that everybody have insurance of some sort. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there may not be enough money to cover the truly sick patients if you don't have enough young, healthy people in the pool. So while lawmakers take the time to figure this out, the danger is could insurance companies just leave the marketplace because they don't want to stick around after the repeal to see what lawmakers come up with years later, perhaps, to replace it with.
Yeah. Well, it just seems really stunning. I find that poll stunning that people who very much supported Trump, and we are hearing anecdotal stories, voices from, let's say, coal country, people saying, well, wait a second, I voted for Trump, but I cannot lose my Obamacare, the only thing covering my black lung disease. I mean, we're hearing these kind of anecdotal stories. But this idea that they expect the Democrats to block Trump. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking for Democrats today after their meeting with President Obama and after the Republicans spoke.
What they would do would throw the entire insurance marketplace into chaos. Plain repeal. It would increase costs for all Americans at all income levels. It would blow a $1 trillion hole in the deficit.
Elsa Chang, you also have Vice President Biden saying things like, go ahead and get rid of things like the list you just mentioned, young people able to stay on their parents, on their parents' insurance. What is the Democrats' strategy here? Just to wait this out?
Well, no. What they're trying to do right now is wage a robust messaging campaign. They're warning the public that more than 20 million people, or well over that, may lose their health care coverage, including swaths of people in states with Republican senators, where Medicaid was expanded under Obamacare, states like West Virginia. In the meantime, Senate Democrats are also trying to get Republicans on the record on various aspects of the health care law. The chamber, as I stated, is considering a budget resolution that will serve as a vehicle for the repeal. And senators will be able to introduce all kinds of amendments to that vehicle in what's called a votorama next week. Democrats will try to force Republicans to vote on provisions like the individual mandate or Medicaid expansion or pre-existing conditions just to make Republicans go on the record about aspects of the health care law.
Okay, well, the fight is on. NPR congressional correspondent Ailsa Chang will be following it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What happens when someone who's not supposed to have a gun lies about their background and illegally tries to buy one? Well, in much of the country, not much. We're going to focus on Washington State today, where FBI records show that between January and August of 2016, nearly 4,000 would-be gun buyers failed a federal background check. But as Austin Jenkins from the Northwest News Network reports, those people are rarely, if ever, pursued.
At Private Sector Arms in Olympia, Washington, they'll sell you a pistol, an AR-15, even a 50-caliber sniper rifle, but not before running a background check.
This is the e-check system. So we insert.
Owner Don Teague shows how it's done. For rifle and shotgun sales, it's an instant check using an FBI system.
Look at how fast that came up. They've already got. Let's retrieve the status.
A couple more punches of the keyboard.
You're green lit, my friend.
Meaning approved for a rifle or shotgun. For pistol purchases in Washington State, the process is a little different. There's the FBI check, but also a local law enforcement check. That can take up to 10 days. Teague says denials are rare in his store, but they do happen.
A lot of times they're like, what? Like, they have no clue. What are you talking about? I've never done anything.
Teague has some sympathy for people in that situation, but...
If it's a felon doing it, absolutely. That guy needs to get strung up for trying to get a gun. That's just straight scary.
Nationally, during a 16-year period from 1998 to 2014, potential gun buyers failed a weapons background check more than a million times. Lying on the federal background check form is a felony, but a recent Inspector General report found that in 2014, federal prosecutors pursued fewer than 50 of those types of cases, a 10-year low. Going after denied pistol buyers is also not a priority for local police in Washington State.
What do? Not a darn thing.
That's King County Sheriff John Urquhart in Seattle. He says the system is working, even if police don't follow up, because the background checks are preventing gun purchases.
There is a gut reaction. People want their pound of flesh. What do you mean this guy's trying to buy a gun and he's a convicted felon? Damn it, he ought to be in jail for doing that. Well, the reality is that's not going to happen.
Urquhart says he doesn't have enough resources to go after failed buyers, and even if he did, Urquhart isn't convinced that pursuing prohibited gun buyers makes sense when the black market for guns is thriving.
We're not going to change gun violence or any sort of violence in the United States by prosecuting these people that tried to buy a gun and shouldn't have been trying to do that. That's really the reality of the situation.
Records from the King County Sheriff's Department reveal that between January and October of last year, 60 would-be pistol buyers living in King County were denied a weapon after a local background check. Many had convictions for domestic assault or had a restraining order against them. Consider Paula's story. We've agreed to just use her first name. She has a permanent protection order against a former longtime boyfriend.
He was extremely scary.
Records show that Paula's ex-boyfriend tried to buy a gun in Pierce County, Washington, in March of 2015. That purchase was blocked after he failed a background check because of the protection order against him. Thing is, no one told Paula.
Victims like me, who have tried so hard to make my life safe, my children's life safe, and I don't even get a courtesy call.
Other denied buyers include people with outstanding warrants, convicted felons, and those who've been involuntarily committed to a mental hospital. One person who thinks the system should go after prohibited buyers is Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, a Democrat. Ferguson recently issued a report titled Access to Firearms in Washington State. That report calls Washington's background check system fragmented and says solutions are needed to follow up on illegal attempts to purchase guns by prohibited buyers.
But it can't just be a lie-and-try system. I then go to the next dealer and the one after that until somehow something falls to cracks and I get that firearm I'm not legally entitled to have.
Ferguson notes that Oregon, for instance, has a centralized background check system run by the state police. When a would-be buyer is denied, that's immediately referred to state or local law enforcement for investigation. Similar systems are in place in Virginia and Pennsylvania. As for Paula, she says just a few years ago she escaped another abusive relationship. She feels like it's important to tell her story, but she also admitted to being afraid to do this interview.
Because I can guarantee I will go to my grave fearing both of them.
These days, Paula says she does carry a gun to protect herself. For Here and Now, I'm Austin Jenkins.
This week, Lego unveiled its latest entry in the Make Kids Smarter While They Have Fun market at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. It's a kit that lets kids build smart toys with the help of sensors and motors, and it's got a heavy dose of coding to make the blocks come alive. While that may help grow the tech workforce down the road, right now when companies want to grow their future coding talent pool, they invite students to their campuses or to an institutional classroom of some kind. But now Google and MIT's Media Lab have started an after-school coding program in the Fruitvale section of Oakland, California, to get kids interested in tech without leaving the neighborhood. Queena Kim of Here and Now contributor KQED checked it out.
The after-school program is called Code Next, and it's located in a storefront in the shopping center next to the Fruitvale Metro train station. Valeria Fornes was there on a recent Tuesday. She's 14 years old and says until now, the extent of her computer skills has been helping her dad troubleshoot his smartphone. She goes to a high school a few miles up the street.
The most fun thing I've made is using the 3D printer, and I made a game.
We're in the lab at Code Next. Behind us is the 3D printer and a laser cutter. And by game, Valeria means a board game. The one she made had little pieces that fit inside the board. I asked Valeria, what does making a board game have to do with coding computers?
Everything's just a big puzzle. If something doesn't work, you have to rearrange almost everything.
We actually introduce kids to coding through making.
April Alvarez is the after school's experience manager. She was part of a team that worked with community members and students to develop the program. And we're in the lab with Valeria. It's the size of a classroom and it has an industrial feel. The floors are concrete, the ceiling is exposed. Alvarez says even the architecture has been carefully planned to reflect CodeNext's teaching philosophy.
We wanted kids to see the inner workings of this space. We wanted them to see the pipes, the wiring, everything that makes this place work.
Google teamed up with MIT's Media Lab to create the CodeNext curriculum. The idea is simple. Coding is also making, and it takes the same problem-solving skills as making things in real life. So instead of lectures on programming, students at CodeNext are assigned projects, like make a board game. And instead of teachers, CodeNext has coaches. Most are trained classroom teachers, but don't necessarily have coding skills. Together, the students and coaches figure out how to make stuff. Brian Goff is a coach at CodeNext.
One thing that's been really, really cool for me is not being a coder, is actually learning with the kids.
These are relatively new ideas. They're broadly seen as a better way to get students engaged, but they're not broadly used.
Hadi Partavi has done a lot of thinking about how to teach computer programming in elementary and high schools. He's the CEO and co-founder of Code.org, a nonprofit that provides computer science curriculum and teacher training to K-12 schools. Code.org is used in 120 school districts nationwide and is funded by tech companies like Microsoft, Facebook, and Google.
You know, when I went to college, the way you'd learn was basically having an expert lecturer deliver the lecture on today's class, and then you just need to take notes.
Partavi says that approach generally works for students who are already into coding, but it's failed to hook students who aren't. And it's these students educators need to reach. In 2015, more than 600,000 tech jobs went unfilled in the United States. Tech companies and the Obama administration have pushed to make computer science a part of the K-12 curriculum. But even in California, home to Silicon Valley, a majority of the high schools don't offer classes in computer programming.
This is still a relatively nascent field, and the majority of our public schools don't teach it. And so computer science is a field that really lends itself to a new pedagogical model.
Partavi says universities from Harvard to Carnegie Mellon and MIT with CodeNext have been taking the lead in creating a new model. While Google plans to open a similar after-school program in Harlem next year, MIT says the immediate goal is to use the program to figure out a curriculum that works and get educators to adopt it. For Here and Now, I'm Queena Kim.
Well, to perform or not to perform at the Trump inauguration, that's been a question performers have been wrestling with. And now school marching bands are wrestling with it as well. After the Trump Inauguration Committee released a list of bands it said were confirmed as participants in the inaugural parade on January 20th. Now petitions are circulating calling for bands not to march. There's one at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, another at Marist College in New York State, and one at Talladega College, home of the Marching Tornadoes. Talladega College is Alabama's oldest private, historically black college, and social media is burning up with comments. There are actually two rival petitions circulating, one for, one against. Anthony Cook is the editor of the Talladega Daily Home, the local newspaper there. He joins us by Skype. And Anthony, what are people saying who want the band to march?
The people who want the band to march are looking at the historical aspect. There are only a certain number of presidents there have ever been for the United States, and we're about to have one more. And to be invited to perform at the inauguration is a great honor, is the argument for those who are saying that the band should play.
Yeah, and we spoke with a Talladega College graduate who started the petition against the band marching. Here's a little of Shirley Farrell.
I don't celebrate his presidency because of the things he has said and done toward members of the African-American community, of which I'm a member. And I don't want my school, my alma mater, my treasured college to support this man in view of these things. He has not apologized in any shape, form, or fashion for any of the stuff he said and done.
Anthony, can you tell us what some people are pointing to, the specifics of what they think Donald Trump has said that would be most offensive to an historically black college?
Well, I think what we have to keep in mind is historically black college, the attendees there feel engendered to all minorities. And so things that he has said about the handicapped, things that he has said about Hispanics, things that he has said about Muslim Americans, those things are all taken personally and felt separately by right. those who are in the historically black college.
Well, and now you've noted that this whole thing could have been avoided if the college president had said initially that, yep, we've been invited, but we haven't decided whether or not to go. The president is supposed to say that today. How else is the school responding? What are you hearing?
That's about it. It has been eerily quiet on campus. Part of that is because it's the holiday period and the students have not been there. But we have a pretty decent working relationship with the leadership there, and we've not heard anything from them in response to all of this.
Yeah. Well, and you have opinions. What do you think should happen?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I'm agnostic. I think there are strong arguments both ways. I just believe that there needs to be a decision made, and you make a case for that decision and stick with it. I think the reason this has turned into a national story to some degree is because the people who are responding feel like they have the opportunity to push the needle one way or the other. I think if a decision had been made early on, there would still be pushback on social media, but not to this degree, I believe.
Yeah. Does the fact that Alabama voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump impact the thinking at all? This is an historically black college, but it's in Alabama. Shouldn't it represent?
Well, I think you know, that's certainly a factor. You know, a lot of the response on social media, a lot of it has been divided almost by race. But you'd be surprised to see some of the people who are arguing on both sides for and against. But I think those who argue in favor are those who have supported Donald Trump in the election. And so there's this understanding that or belief that he ought to be given a chance to have a black college there and to represent not only Talladega College, but also the city of Talladega and also the state of Alabama, I think is the argument being made that is a huge deal. It's historic and it's an opportunity to put a positive bow on what has been a long campaign.
Remind people that Talladega is much more than the Will Ferrell movie, as many of us already know.
Absolutely.
Anthony Cook, this is a, you know, can be a vicious time on social media. We understand this has been, you know, hugely hot topic on your website, but also you've had to take some comments down. I mean, how do you think it's going to be dangerous or threatening?
I don't think so. I think people are just really passionate. And those passions have been stoked for the last 18 months throughout this presidential campaign. But also on a more local level, people are passionate about this band. This is a really good, excellent band. They were invited a couple of months ago to perform during halftime at a New Orleans Saints football game. So everybody loves them. They are high energy. They're typical of what you see with HBCU bands, and they will put on an excellent show if they decide to go. But if they decide not to go, it will be a strong statement in what some believe needs to be made about this presidency.
Anthony Cook, editor of the Talladega Daily Home there in Talladega, Alabama. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And again, the marching tornadoes from Talladega College. We await the school's decision, but we seize any excuse to play a good marching band. Here they are. It's Here and Now.
If you're thinking about a beach vacation to escape the winter, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention wants to remind you that Zika is still very much a problem in much of the Caribbean and Latin America, particularly if you're pregnant. CDC Director Tom Frieden tells our partners at the health and medicine publication STAT that he's concerned that many people think they no longer need to worry about Zika. Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for STAT. And Helen, why is the director of the CDC concerned that people are not worried enough about Zika anymore?
There's lots of evidence that people don't know how seriously to take this outbreak. It's unusual. It's not, you know, normally when you have an infectious disease outbreak, a whole bunch of people get sick. People know people who get sick, and there's sort of a rippling through the society of understanding of what's going on. But with Zika, it's a much more invisible process almost. You know, women who are pregnant and get infected may end up having a baby with birth defects, but it'll be months before anybody knows that. And numbers are still quite low in the United States. Also, numbers elsewhere are kind of confusing. Brazil has high numbers of cases in comparison to most of the other countries where Zika has been spreading. So it seems like Zika is a hard outbreak for people to get their head around.
Well, is the problem getting worse or better in some of the places that you mentioned, or is the outbreak staying roughly the same?
The assumption at the CDC is that places that have seen Zika outbreak starts will have Zika spreading there for some time, not months, but probably years. The Americas have been naive to Zika in the past, so virtually everyone here is susceptible to it. So that means once it gets into a community, it will spread for quite a while before it runs out of people it can infect. Consequently, there are big parts of Latin America and the Caribbean where the CDC is really urging pregnant women not to go these days. You know, if anybody was planning a beach vacation in the Caribbean this winter and they're pregnant, they really ought to think again.
Well, in fact, when you talked to the CDC director, he told you that we do want to emphasize that this will be the new normal until there's a Zika vaccine and that pregnant women should not go to a place where Zika is spreading. So that makes me wonder, have we come any closer to a vaccine?
Well, there's a lot of work being done. It's actually being done at a very quick rate for vaccine development. That said, there is still a ways to go before anybody will be able to purchase a Zika vaccine. And it remains to be seen what the economics of a Zika vaccine are. If demand is high, pharmaceutical companies will make a Zika vaccine and it will become available, but that has to be the case. If they become convinced that a market for a Zika vaccine just isn't really there, we could see what happened with the West Nile virus vaccine work happen again with Zika. When West Nile was new to North America, there was a big push to develop a vaccine. But at the end of the day, the pharmaceutical companies did some analyses and concluded that there really wasn't enough demand for the vaccine to bring it to market because it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to do so. And so there is still no West Nile vaccine.
Hmm. Well, Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for our partners at STAT. Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When President Obama took office in 2009, he called Afghanistan the good war, and he promised to end it. That hasn't happened, and our next guest says Afghanistan could be the Trump administration's first foreign policy crisis. Jonathan Schroden is director of the Center for Stability and Development at CNA, a research and analysis organization. He wrote about Afghanistan for the War on the Rocks website, and he's with us from NPR in Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, you've written that just as was the case back in 2009, when President Obama first came into office in January 2009, you see the war in Afghanistan now trending in the wrong direction. Tell us more. Why is that happening?
Probably the most salient point that I think you could look at in terms of reasons to be concerned about Afghanistan's future stems from the fact that over the course of the past year, the 2016 fighting season, the Taliban were able to attack and occasionally infiltrate into five different provincial capitals in the country. And in fact, they attacked several of those numerous times. So there were eight overall attacks and some incursions into various provincial capitals. Compare that to one attack and incursion that occurred last year in 2015 and zero that occurred in the several years before that. So I mean, that's just one specific indicator that you could look at that causes pause with respect to the security situation as it's unfolding in Afghanistan.
Well, and there's significant reason to feel that pause because as you write, I mean, I just want to read a whole paragraph from what you've written here because it's very sobering. You write,
sure.
Remember Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history, where the U.S., its allies in NATO, and several partner nations still have in excess of 13,000 troops on the ground, where the U.S. spent last year approximately $3.6 billion on security force assistance alone, where the U.S. has been dropping ever larger numbers of bombs since President Obama gave forces more expansive authorities to achieve so-called strategic effects. I mean, even with all of that, the Taliban is gaining ground right now?
Yeah, I mean, it really stems from, right, there was a transition that took place at the end of 2014 from what was largely a U.S. and also, you know, NATO ally-led campaign against the Taliban to an Afghan-led campaign. And so as part of that, the U.S. and its NATO allies drew down quite a few of their forces, as I think most people know, and left a sizable contingent behind on the order of 10 to 15,000 troops. And the idea was that the Afghans, we thought, were strong enough, their security forces were strong enough to step into the lead and hold the gains that we had helped them achieve over the past few years. And what we've seen over the past couple of years is that those security forces have proven not nearly as strong or as resilient as we thought. And so, especially over the course of the last year, what you saw is some amount of backtracking in terms of the planned further drawdown of U.S. troops and the reintroduction of these strategic effects authorities, which allows U.S. forces in Afghanistan to offensively target the Taliban and the Islamic State in Afghanistan with airstrikes and other means, which was a pretty big step because prior to that, the authorities were such that the U.S. forces in Afghanistan could only respond in times of self-defense with things like airstrikes.
Hmm. So the security situation is deteriorating. The country's civil infrastructure also in a pretty terrible state. I mean, you write that the parliament just dismissed 7 government ministers and the first vice president had publicly beaten and kidnapped a political rival. So, I mean, given both the civil infrastructure problems, the security problems you're outlining, I mean, do we have any sense as to what the Trump administration's strategy will be in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really open question. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this article was to try and stimulate further discussion on that because as somebody who's worked on Afghanistan for the last 9 years or so, I found it pretty disconcerting that it was not addressed at all in the presidential debates or really at any meaningful way along the presidential campaigns. As best as I can tell, the Trump administration transition team hasn't yet sort of made clear what their views on Afghanistan are or what the president-elect's views on Afghanistan are. I think a primary question on the table is what is the length and depth of the commitment of the new administration to the war in Afghanistan? I think, you know, answering that question then leads down a whole set of different paths, depending on, you know, whether you're more interested in a long-term approach or a rough continuation of the sort of short, let's see if we can get out of here in the next couple of years approach that we've been trying for the last 5 to 6 years.
Well, we'll have to wait for some clarity on the answer to that question. But, I mean, is there anything that we can read on a potential strategy based on who the president-elect has picked to help lead foreign policy? I mean, his nominees for Secretary of State or General Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor.
I have worked with General Flynn and General Mattis, the Trump administration's pick for Secretary of Defense in the past. I suspect that based on their history of involvement with the war in Afghanistan and their sort of deep and nuanced understanding of that war and the actors involved in the situation there, I have to believe that they have a pretty sobering view of the conflict on the ground and sort of where we stand right now as well.
Hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about how we got here, specifically meaning President Obama's legacy in Afghanistan. Because in September of last year, the president gave an interview with the New York Times, and he was asked whether or not he thought his Afghanistan policy had been a failure. And here was his answer.
So while it is true that we still have several thousand troops there, and while it is true that that's always dangerous and always tough for our brave men and women in uniform, and that occasionally there have been significant casualties associated with that, for the most part, this is now an Afghan fight.
It seems as if the president was working really hard there to qualify his answer. I mean, how do you assess President Obama's legacy in Afghanistan?
You know, looking at his policies over the last 8 years, what I would say is I think there's clearly some disappointment on behalf of the administration that they weren't able to sort of wind down the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, you know, more substantially than they were able to, as well as some disappointment that the surge in troops that we sent to Afghanistan shortly after Obama took office didn't have more of an effect that they did, which is not to say that they didn't have an effect. They actually had quite a great effect. They significantly weakened the Taliban and put that movement back on its heels for a number of years. But I think, you know, the transition to the Afghan security forces did not go as smoothly or as easily as we had hoped or planned. And so we now find ourselves in a situation where we're having to do more and assume a bit more control and certainly a lot more support of those Afghan security forces than was originally planned or hoped for. So that's a nuanced answer to what seems to be a very simple question. But I don't think you can say it's been a failure, nor do I think you can say it's been as resounding a success as we might have hoped.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you, this is America's longest war. The conflict or American military involvement in Afghanistan is now in its 16th year. We have yet another president who's going to be inheriting what's going on in Afghanistan. And you say in your piece that Afghanistan in 2017 is again the, quote, forgotten war, that it's taken a backseat to Iraq and other military conflicts. What does the United States risk? What are the dangers that we face when Afghanistan has become the forgotten war in the minds of most Americans?
Yeah, I mean, there's a point that the commander of forces in Afghanistan now, General Nicholson, makes when he gives briefings, which is of the designated terrorist organizations that exist globally, 20 of them have a presence in either Afghanistan or Pakistan. I think it's like 13 in Afghanistan and 7 in Pakistan. So it's a sort of sobering reminder that this is a very dangerous part of the world. And so, you know, turning our back on Afghanistan is just really not a feasible or logical option, especially when you look at the history of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, right? I mean, us sort of abandoning the Mujahideen in the wake of their victory against the Soviets didn't turn out very well for us. And I think, you know, any even slight student of history would take that lesson to heart when it comes to thinking about the future of Afghanistan as well.
Jonathan Schroden is director of the Center for Stability and Development at CNA. We have a link to his piece about the Afghan war at our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Would you like to have a more healthy diet? How about cutting down the amount of meat in your diet, maybe just one day a week? That is a movement called Meatless Mondays. And here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is in the studio with more. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Robin.
And we should point out for a lot of people, every day is Meatless Day. But this Meatless on Monday movement, how did that start?
You know, I was fascinated because I thought it was sort of a trendy, newish thing. It turns out it goes back to World War I when the United States Food Administration was urging families to reduce the amount of key staples that they ate to aid the war effort. So there was Meatless Monday. There was also Wheatless Wednesday. And Americans did it. More than 13 million families signed a pledge. Then during World War II, Roosevelt helped relaunch it to help the war efforts on the home front. And it goes on and on. But then it was really reintroduced yet again through Johns Hopkins and several public health schools to try to create a healthier diet for Americans that lean much too heavily on large consumption of meat.
Huh. Well, and by the way, some people may still have, and some of us may remember, Meatless Fridays, in which you had fish sticks. It's cool.
Yeah, I remember as a kid there was always fish sticks on Fridays, but I never understood.
Well, apparently there's many Catholics who have meatless days for different reasons, different religious reasons, but this is for health reasons. Tell us more about this. This is, you know, what, cutting down on certain fats, better for the planet? What
exactly.
Are the benefits?
I spoke to food writer Kim O'Donnell, who's based in Seattle, and she told me that she has a bad family history of heart disease. Her dad died of a heart attack at 37, and it was one of the major reasons that she shifted from mostly meat to less meat. And she started writing a column for the Washington Post years ago, and it really caught on. There was Al Gore who was involved with all of this. Meatless Monday became a big deal. So what does it mean in a day-to-day level? On Monday, Monday's always the day that, you know how it is, Sunday night, you're kind of disgusted with yourself, the excesses of the weekend. Come Monday morning, you're like, okay, it's a new week. I'm going to be good. I remember my mother every single Monday morning going, starting my diet today. Today's the day. And there is that mentality about Monday. So I think it was connected to that. All it means is you shift your focus. Mm-hmm. So instead of vegetables being on the side of the plate, they're at the center. And I made three dishes today that I think prove how very possible it is, how easy it is, and delicious. Let's start with that. That is an eggplant parmesan.
Oh, a favorite.
But instead of drenching it in tons of oil, I took a whole eggplant and I roasted it till it was just about soft.
So you didn't slice it?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Nope. Let it cool. It sort of collapses. Then I sliced it and I interspersed it with a tomato sauce and fresh mozzarella. And then there's a little bit of panko breadcrumbs on the top. Almost no oil whatsoever. So it is healthy and it is fully satisfying. Give that a taste.
It's filling.
It's filling. That is absolutely a main course Meatless Monday dish. I love eggplant and I love roasting them because I hate when you saute them, how it's just a sponge for oil no matter what.
Mm.
Nice, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Good mozzarella is key.
Mm, that's great. Okay.
Next, another main course meatless Monday. That's a winter vegetable curry. Mm-hmm. It's a thick, creamy curry. It's got turmeric, cilantro, garam masala, and cinnamon. I actually added a cinnamon stick to the curry.
Oh, man.
And it's got chopped toasted cashews on top with basmati rice. Garam masala.
That's that.
An Indian spice. Lots of chopped ginger in there also.
Oh, man.
Isn't that nice? And the creaminess comes from a little bit of sour cream and water. And then I added spinach, or you could add Swiss chard or kale at the end, and it kind of just melts into the curry.
This is amazing.
Honestly, less than half an hour.
And the ginger?
The ginger comes next.
Okay.
The ginger comes for the third dish.
This is a piece of ginger that's on
that the, is a yeah. piece of fresh ginger that you are excited to use. Mm-hmm. I know, because this is interactive eating. The next dish is a roasted carrot and ginger soup. This comes from my new book, Soup Swap, and this is such a soup. I love this soup. It would be a main course with a winter salad. So I roasted carrots and onions, and then I throw them into a homemade vegetable stock. Then I steep a cup of ginger tea. Take a bag of ginger tea, mm-hmm. steep it till it's really strong, and I strain that into the soup. So you're adding ginger in all these different levels. And then I brought you a microplane or a grater with a fresh knob of ginger. And the idea is that you grate that.
Tools.
Right. Tools. This okay. is interactive eating, Robin. Now you, yeah, exactly. You got it. Just grate it right onto the soup, and you get this ping of fresh ginger right on top of the soup. So you're tasting ginger in the cooked soup, ginger in the ginger tea, and then this fresh sparkle of bright ginger on the very top.
Oh, man, if I had a cold,
yeah, exactly,
it's gone.
Exactly. But these are all really satisfying meatless main courses. Get you through this time of year, help you feel healthier, less impact on the environment, less impact on your body. So you go meatless on Monday. Maybe you do it again on Thursday. Maybe not. Isn't that ginger fabulous?
It's I'm speechless. So we must
we
end.
Like to make
yes.
you speechless.
We'll have all of Kathy's recipes at hereandnow.org. And you've outdone yourself, my
oh,
friend.
Thank you, Rob. Yeah.